Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. I am absolutely thrilled to have attorney Warren Scheel back with us for the third time. This is so delightful, Warren, that we're doing a series of interviews. First, we started with prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements with just you. Then we went into an episode with Alex LaViolette, an absolutely wonderful therapist and expert witness on domestic violence. And today we have joining you J.B. Rizzo, who is a partner in Frankel, Reichman, and Rizzo. It's a firm that does a lot within the world of mathematics for family law, but essentially J.B. is here to talk about his role as a forensic accountant, helping people like Warren, a wonderful family law attorney, divide assets and debts and come up with information for support. So the three areas that we're going to be working with today are how to divide a business, how to divide a house, and how to determine spousal and child support. So gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Judith.
Thank you, Judith.
You're so happy to have you here, JB. So let's start with, you both work together, mostly with higher net worth clients when you're talking about dividing businesses and real estate, or sometimes the average middle income client, is that true as well?
Yes. I mean, in my case, it's usually the folks that are higher net worth. However, there are many of my cases that I would consider smaller cases to just help folks unwind their financial assets. Sometimes they just need a little help, and sometimes they need to hear it from a third party to give them assistance in dividing their assets and determining support.
How about with you, Warren?
Yeah, I mean, usually we retain a forensic accountant if there is a complicated matter relating to cash flow and we have to do a calculation for a child support or spousal support, and the person isn't simply a W-2 wage earner and has different sources of income. Then additionally, when there's additional issues such as the valuation of a business or a complicated asset, or there's a stream of income, for example, say from royalties, we bring in a forensic accountant. And I suppose the other big area where we also bring in a forensic accountant would be tracing. That's usually where there's a claim by one of the spouses that the an asset, usually a fund, is mixed. It's partly separate property and partly community property, and then the accountant does a tracing spreadsheet and tries to figure out what the community part of that is.
And do you find that more in real estate than any other asset, Warren?
Well, tracing, no, not necessarily. When real estate, the area where I'm presently using forensic accountants would be where there is a house that was purchased before marriage and the title is in one spouse's name. But during the marriage, there was a pay down of the mortgage and there was no prenuptial agreement, so that's community income, or that there was a refinance of the mortgage during marriage. And so we bring in, because lawyers are really bad at math. We just can't add up, 2 and 2 equals 4. We're just really, and accountants, they're good at math.
So when
we're good at arguing.
So wait a minute, Warren. So when people get your bills, should they be concerned with the math?
Yeah, they should retain J.B. Rizzo to go through my bill.
Okay, so houses are really, really important. So let's go through how you deal with the house. There's so many different scenarios. And you brought up a great one. House is owned by one spouse prior to the marriage, or it's inherited, and then they go to pay it down with monies they've earned from their jobs, community property dollars, right?
That's correct. I'm going to just briefly give the big picture, and then I'll I'll defer to JB, because JB does a lot of these. And you might hear the expression, more Marsden. Those are cases, the cases of Moore and Marsden. And then you might hear Branco, that's another case. And the bottom line is this, we have a lot of different formulas and equations. And when the community adds value to something or contributes, then the community gets an interest. So what happens in those cases is that you have often two sets of accountants fighting over what they think the more Marsden interest is. And typically you have, you know, two extreme positions. The person who's on title has usually possibly gotten a quit claim or interspousal transfer deed from the other spouse saying everything belongs to them. And that position, the extreme position is, well, there is no community. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the other spouse who's basically claiming that there's a very large community interest based upon the pay down of the mortgage, possibly a refinance during the mortgage, maybe improvements that are made. And there's so many cases. And the thing about California, particularly Los Angeles, is that there's been a huge appreciation in real property. So we're often talking about millions of dollars at stake. And that's when I bring in my expert, who's one of the best accountants in the business, JB Rizzo.
Take it away, JB.
Thank you, Warren. To just expand a little bit on what Warren's talking about is that a situation where there's a house, we're looking at how the principal, the debt pay down, the debt pay down of the principal, whether that came from community property or separate property. And then we're taking those numbers and coming up with ratios as far as how to divide the house. The community gains an interest in the house when it pays down the debt. And that is what we're looking at. Now, it can get quite complicated because you're looking at that in every refinance. And there's a controversy on the refinance proceeds, but those are community property or separate property can also skew these calculations. So it is important when you bring a house into a marriage and then when you're dissolving your marriage that you have someone assist you looking at that asset to determine the community property versus separate property interests.
So a couple things on that then. If you want to refinance, sometimes you just refinance for a lower interest rate and you don't take cash out. Can the house remain separate property if it was originally separate property at the state of the, at the beginning of the marriage if you don't take cash out?
Yeah, what you want to do is, most people don't think about this when they're in a marriage, is that most banks will force you to put the house in joint names in order to get the loan. It is like a typical one of their processes. And so what happens many times is folks go through and they change the deed over to joint parties, and then they forget to do a quick claim deed right after the transaction to put the property back into the title of the one spouse that held it before. So that is just one of the complications in that can occur in a refinance.
Okay, but before we leave this point, I want to
think of that.
Well, hold on, JB. I want to be clear about something because I'm not. So in the scenario that you just presented, is the house owned by one spouse prior to the marriage?
That's what I was assuming.
Then why would it have to be titled in both parties' names at some point?
Because when you go through a refinance, many times banks will require that as part of the refinancing process. They will want to see that if they, because they're looking at the community income and they're looking at the community assets. Many times it's like a check the box type of thing for the banks, not all banks, but I see that a lot happening. People didn't realize that they put the house in one spouse's name when they were going through the process. They were just doing what the bankers told them to do and signing a bunch of documents on what they were told to sign.
Would they absolutely have to put it in both spouses' name if the owning spouse had a lot of money?
No, they don't have to. I'm talking about just what banks may require.
Okay, great. Now, but so I want our
always case by case.
Okay, so I want our audience to know that this is a potential, this is a spot where they have to pay attention, and they can choose not to put both spouses' names on if the owning spouse who wants to refinance can qualify quite well on his or her own.
Correct. That's why I was bringing it up. I'm thinking of things that people don't always think about when they are going through their happily married time period. But then at the end, or when we're going through this dissolution process, these are the things that pop up that you see a bunch regarding the house.
And I just want to jump in there that the phrase happily married time period, that is not a term of art. So I just don't want anyone to mistake that we're mistaking the marital period from the date of marriage to date of separation as the happily married time period. Because if the happily married time period was actually a measure of anything, for example, the length of time you pay spousal support, it probably wouldn't be very, very long in many cases.
Yes, thank you, Warren. I'm a bit of an optimist, and I like to think that people at some point during their marriages were happy.
I love that.
We're making an assumption
This is audio, right? You can't see us. The people listening to this can't see us.
Correct. And we're all three smiling broadly while we're communicating.
Good. Excellent.
Right. Okay, so JB and Warren, how would one spouse completely keep the house separate property once they got married? What do they need to do in terms of paying mortgage, if there's mortgage, and of course ongoing property taxes?
They would hire me.
Without a doubt.
If I told them now, they wouldn't hire me. But no, basically what you're trying to do is you're going to be, you're going to make sure the title documents properly reflect that it's owned by, you know, the spouse that owned it prior to marriage. And I think to be on the safe side, either in that particular spousal transfer document or in a separate document, you would make sure that the community would acquire no more Marsden or Branco interests. And you would specifically state that. You would waive that as part of the agreement.
But go ahead, JB.
I think what Warren's referring to is like part of a prenuptial agreement.
Prenup would be the best way to go. But if you haven't got a prenup, then you would have a limited postnup.
Got it.
Brief postnup agreement.
And you know, from the financial point of view, if possible, the other way would be if there's separate property that exists, would be to always pay the mortgage down from a separate property source. But if they do, that's the way to keep it.
Well, that's where I was going with this. I would like you to explain to people. The person who owns the house prior to coming into the marriage, and it's understood that this would remain separate property, at least at the beginning of the marriage, how do they then pay for the mortgage? Okay, what are the things they would pay for? Let's do it this way, that would make it community if they used the monies they made on their jobs. The mortgage and the property taxes and improvements, any of those would make it community?
Well, let's back up and be clear that absent a prenuptial or postnuptial agreement to the contrary, the earnings of both spouses during the marriage is community earnings. So anything that earnings uses to either spend on community living or invest in assets can generate a community property asset. Potentially. So to keep it on the financial aspect purely to allow for the community not to gain any interest, any more Marsden that we're talking about, would be not to use earnings to pay the mortgage and perhaps improvements and such. So absent that and absent a prenup or a postnup, I don't know of a situation to where they can completely protect it.
Right. And
the earnings to pay.
I know this is the hardest part when people come into the offices and it's clearly understood this is one person's house, yet they've paid for the house at the inception of the marriage with monies they've made on their jobs. And of course, every smart person gets legal advice before they file for a divorce. And this is when the reality hits them, right, Warren?
Yeah, the reality hits them. And often there is an understanding. There may be an understanding when they entered into this, but they didn't have a prenup. And so maybe there were some verbal assurances or agreements that it would remain, let's say, for example, the wife's separate property, and the wife put in a bunch of separate income into it. But then, you know, things change. They get divorced and you're looking at a huge asset worth millions of dollars. And they go into the attorney's office, and the husband's attorney says, you know, I don't think, you know, maybe she can't prove that separate property contribution. It was such a long time ago. Let's ask if they've got proof, documents. And that all becomes leverage. And so during mediation, hopefully people take a reasonable position and they can work things out. But once it becomes litigated, then people are going to fall back onto things like these cases, and they're fall back on what can be proven, what is traceable, what is admissible evidence. And that can be a sort of rude comeuppance for someone.
And judges, when they rule on things, there's no emotion in it, right? I understand that you didn't know, and because you didn't know, we're not going to make this community. It's strictly by the book, right?
Yeah, it's strictly by the book, and the court only takes into consideration admissible evidence. Now, even though the family court is a court of equity, at the same time, the court has to apply the statutes and the case law.
JB, anything to add?
Yeah, I would, for the lay folks out there, when you're living your life and when they're going through this, a lot of clients think in terms of his or hers or mine or yours. And, our court system in California is set up that it's the community versus the separate. And each party is 50% of the community. And the laws are tilted in favor of the community. So I hear a lot from clients, especially describing the situation that Warren was talking about as far as not being able to prove separate property. You know, well, that's not fair. Well, that's not fair. And I agree with them. It's like, no, who says this is a fair game, or who says that the law is fair? It's in fact not. It's favored towards the community. And sometimes from the point of view of one client or the other, they don't see it that way. They more see it as his and hers. And so if a person that comes into a marriage with assets, house, bank accounts, or whatnot, keep good records of that information and get a prenup or a postnup when you can. But realize that as time goes by, and if you lose records or don't keep records, it becomes increasingly difficult for folks like me to be able to trace, to prove that separate property. And if you went the litigated route, as Warren says, you will not get acknowledgement of that separate property. It will be just presumed community unless you can prove it. You have the burden to prove it via a trace.
Now, when JB said mentioned fairness, and it reminded me of a very well-known story. It's a story, I don't know if it's a true case or not, but where there was this big civil jury trial, and the worth many millions of dollars, and the jury goes out to deliberate, And then the jury comes back and the client, the plaintiff, goes outside in the hallway and says, like, the attorney says, don't you want to listen to the verdict? And he says, I'm too nervous. I'm too anxious. Come out and tell me what the decision was. So the jury delivers the verdict, and the attorney comes out and says to the client, justice was done. And the client says, appeal immediately. So justice and what's fair isn't always the same thing.
Oh, too funny. Okay, I have an extreme example before we leave the division of a house. So let's just say house is owned by one spouse prior to the marriage. That spouse has used separate property funds to pay for the mortgage, the property taxes, everything but one thing. Improvements. This is the one thing that the other spouse invested in, improvements. How much did, with money that he or she earned from their employment? Now, how much of that house is community because of that one investment?
Depends whether it was a swimming pool or not.
How do you argue with a pool versus without a pool?
Yeah, in this weather. This is really complicated because there's a couple of conflicting cases on this. So I can't even begin to, and I think this goes way over the head of our audience, but there are a couple of cases
that take. It comes up.
Well, there's a case called Sherman, and there's a case called Bono and Clark. And I can't even begin to imagine how to explain that without looking at having a spreadsheet in front of me.
So I think that's why JB's here. JB, why don't you take a crack at that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could at least give you a first. I agree with Warren, but second, I can give you a first pass on whether it's even enough to talk about, because improvements can mean a lot of different things. And the improvements that would matter, what your client think about, is the improvements that improve the value of the property, separate and distinct from deferred maintenance. Okay, so someone, you buy a new roof. Okay, well, roofs, you know, they only last a certain amount of years. And so while that might have appeal to in a selling and a marketing aspect, people would assume that you buy a house, it has a working roof. So that wouldn't increase the value per se. Now, that compared to maybe adding a bedroom and a bathroom, so now you have a 4-bedroom house instead of a 3-bedroom house, and 4 bathrooms instead of 3, clearly that's something that's going to increase the value of the house. And so now you might have something to talk about. So I think that's a first pass, first cut of whether you have deferred maintenance versus improvements. No painting, okay, that's just painting. That's just deferred maintenance. That's not going to improve the value. It's usually, this is something of significance. Before you start to go down the road of, does the community get reimbursed for it, or does it perhaps create a similar, more Marsden type of interest? I mean, those are the complicated issues that Warren's really talking about, and could go either way on many of these things. But the first pass, is it a significant improvement?
I think that was an absolutely excellent answer, because this does happen, that the improvements that one spouse decided to make become a point of, how do we deal with this? How much does this make the asset a community asset? And I think that was brilliant what you just said. And then further, does it improve the house in terms of improving the value? And then further, does that one event, paying for improvements, make it a reimbursable amount of money versus a community property discussion with a percentage of the house going towards the community?
And I would say probably more likely than not, it's like a reimbursement type of issue, and less likely to create like a pro rata interest.
Just great response. Anything from you, Warren, before I go on to the family business?
No, I think that's a good response. I mean, the when JB says it's more likely to create a reimbursement claim rather than a prorate of interest, I think it depends who you're representing, and that's usually the problem. So you do the math and figure out, is that going to benefit your client? Because if you want to take a prorate of interest, you're going to say that the improvements increase the value, and you're going to include those improvements in your more Marsden calculation. You're going to add those to the denominator and the numerator when you do get the formula, or you're going to perhaps get a cost-based approach, or maybe you'll get an appraisal done, and you'll ask the appraiser to do a current value appraisal based on the property with and without the improvements, and then maybe add that on at the end.
That sounds
so there's a lot of different options.
Yeah. That sounds very reasonable too. Okay, let's go to the other asset that we all spend a lot of time with, and that is the family business. And I know there's a lot to talk about, so how do you approach, I'll throw this out to JB first. JP, how do you approach the division of a family business for its asset value?
Well, the simple way is that, I mean, we value the business, and then one spouse will buy out the other for 50% of that value. But you know, before I even get to whether I'm valuing a business and, you know, what that amount might be, my first pass is to consider whether we really, you know, have a business in the first place that's worth valuing, worth spending the professional fees on me and on the lawyers to fight about. I'm thinking, you know, and the first pass for the lay people out there could be simply, you know, what is this person making ballpark for in the business versus what he could be making outside as in a job, in whatever the field it is. And so the first pass cut is that you should be making a lot more money being a business owner than being an employee from somewhere else. That's not always the case, but you want to first pass that, because if someone is making about the same or even a little bit less than what they would be making doing a job doing the similar services, then maybe you don't have a business that's worth valuing, or maybe you do have a business that has a very low, what we call goodwill value. And then the easy way to divide the business would be just to list the assets and the liabilities of the business, you know, on what we call a community property balance sheet, and just put a relatively small number in for goodwill. Just because someone is operating via a corporation or via some other entity does not always mean they got a business worth millions of dollars, right? Because I don't know if the lay people out there know, but forming a corporation, you can basically download some documents, file some documents with the Secretary of State, pay a minimum amount of money, open up a bank account. I mean, it's paperwork. It's not what creates value. What creates value is the economics of the business model that enables you to make more money than you would otherwise being an accountant for somebody, or being a lawyer in a firm working for someone, or being a plumber and working for someone versus a plumber that's out there with his own truck and running around versus a plumber that has 20 employees and 20 different trucks and is franchised. I mean, all those scenarios are all very different. So, you know, it's a long-winded answer, but the short answer is to first consider, do you really have a real business here, or do you have something else? And then if you do have the real business, somebody like me or somebody like my colleagues, we value businesses all the time, and we would place a number on that business, and it would be divided accordingly.
Different ways to value a business, JB?
Yeah, there are many different ways to value a business. They're generally organized in three theoretical approaches, if you will. A cost approach, an asset-based, a cost approach or an asset-based approach, they mean the same thing, or an income-based approach, and a market-based approach. The market-based approach simply looks for comps like you do in houses, looks for similar businesses that sold, and uses that information to value the business. An income-based approach looks at the income by that business, the risk of receiving that income, and derives value from that type of a calculation. And then the asset or cost-based approach looks at simple balance sheet items, lists out all the assets, all the liabilities that one can identify, marking each one of those to market, and derives value that way. Generally, the asset or cost-based approach is not used for operating companies. That's more used for companies that hold real estate or hold stocks or something, what we call holding companies. So your operating companies are basically valued market data, market approaches, or income analysis, income-based methods.
Okay, so if I had a general store, a 7-Eleven, what approach would be taken with that type of business?
Yeah, a 7-Eleven, you know, that's like a franchise-based thing. So that's going to have a lot of market data out there. Convenience stores in general buy and sell all the time. So that is a great business that would be an example where I would look to market data. I would look to other convenience stores that sold and use that data to compare to my company. There are a few of those types of businesses that I call, you know, buy and sell all the time. Dry cleaners, liquor stores, convenience stores, tax accounting practices, restaurants, buy and sell all the time too. So certain industries have really good market data. Other industries don't.
How about a service business where it's you, the human being is the business?
Right. Those are always, advise your audience, always look at these very carefully because they're going to create a lot of, one, emotional issues because many folks don't understand that California law does view a solo professional practice as a business to be valued. And so you want to be, you know, mindful of that because that's every client that comes in. Say the business is just me. I can't sell it. It has no value. Done. End of discussion. But California family law is very clear that those businesses, while they are not sellable in the marketplace, they have value in divorce land. And one of the ways that we value them is to a real simple method looking at excess earnings. Does this person make more money than a similarly situated professional does in whatever it is that they do? And if they are making more than a similarly situated professional, you could potentially have a goodwill value there. And there's a multiple that's applied to that amount. And therefore, you can derive value. Then you add in the other assets and liabilities.
Hey, JB, can I ask you a question? Why do we look at that excess value? Why do we say that you have to be earning more than a similarly situated professional for there to be goodwill? And secondly, what do we mean by similarly situated professional? Like take the example of a lawyer, for example.
What a similarly situated professional for a lawyer means would be a lawyer like Warren, who is well established, who has many, many years of experience, and he is tops of his game, versus an average of a salary of a lawyer that just might be, say, 5 years out of law school and an employee of a big law firm. You know, the average salary of a lawyer is going to be much less than a similarly situated professional. And you're trying to capture the similarly situated professional in most cases. So I forgot the other part of Warren's question, but basically, why do we look at this? It's just one method of the few or the many that are out there that is an accepted method to value the businesses. I didn't make up that value. That methodology was made up by the IRS in the 1920s to value distilleries when they did prohibition. But it is today when no other method is more reliable or better than that. The reason.
Can I just pick up on that? So, this valuation method, this capitalization of excess earnings, you're saying was created in the 1920s to value, breweries and distilleries.
Yeah.
During prohibition.
Correct. It was made up by the IRS when they seized those businesses to give those owners some value, the goodwill value of those businesses. Yeah, and it was, so the reason why it's not a great method is because the IRS made it up in the first place, and then the IRS backed away from it and said, no, this isn't a great method. This is only the method of last resort. But it also got picked up in California family law cases like in the 1970s and 80s as methodology to use in professional practices. So we kind of have this back and forth that seasoned valuation analysts know that this method is kind of very subjective. However, it is commonly used in California family law courts when you're valuing tough businesses like professional practices. Professional practices have aspects of being a job and have aspects or attributes of being a business. And so it operates in this kind of a gray area from the analyst's point of view, because there are businesses that have very little tangible assets, right? I mean, you look at Warren and I mean, we have us, we have our computers, we have some desks. That's
you have your brains, and that's where the real value is it not?
Right, and how do you value my brain, and why do I have to pay you percent of my brain? It's a whole other type of issue, but... And anyway, so it is what it is. I advise, clients that are in mediations with you, Judy, to really, talk about a lot of these issues, but, to try not to get into conflict here, because you are dealing in a gray area that, it's not easy to settle around, but should settle around, because when you get, these are the high stakes court battles that like Warren and I are in many times. And, while we do great jobs and no doubt that we're very confident in what we do, and likewise, our opponents are likewise, you don't want to leave those big decisions up to a court. There's a little more gambling in it for me. I'm a bit more conservative.
Understood.
High stakes.
Okay, so I want to go to that extraordinary situation that we're dealing with today, and that's COVID. So a petition for divorce is filed for. On the petition, you have date of marriage, date of separation, and now you've exchanged your disclosures and you're doing your valuations all the way around. You may or may not go to trial, I don't know, but COVID has now entered our lives, and we're not doing the business that we thought. And maybe we have a restaurant business that we're a little concerned may not be around when we can be fully operational. So how has the COVID issue impacted the valuation process for you, both of you?
Well, we're in it right now, so I don't think anybody has solid answers to know which way is the right way. I would say that there are a few different ways that you can be able to handle it. And a lot of it will depend upon the type of business and depend upon the type of impact. While this is a strange time, we've been through downtimes before. The 2008 financial crash was a mess. Days after 9/11 was a mess. So there are other times. So these times are going to be gotten through, if you will, and hopefully the businesses are going to survive this situation. So the first thing is to analyze, is this a short-term problem or a long-term problem? And also from the legal point of view, it is, value is always on a given date, as of a given date. So that's actually a legal determination that I'm given from the lawyers, is that what is my date of value? And as a valuation analyst, I only look at what is known or knowable as of that date of value. So that the same business valuing today or valued 2 years ago, they're going to have different values because of the moments in time. And I would also say that part of the valuation process that we go through, the main part, the hard part, if you will, about business valuation is assessing the business risk, the risk of the business. In every business valuation that I do, in every business out there, there is risk that that business will fail. It is possible, it has happened, and that is that risk assessment is what every valuation analyst goes through. So COVID is just a very large, a very clear, a very compelling example of the business risk that is out there for business owners.
Warren, how would you argue it, though, if a business was given a value prior to COVID, you haven't yet finalized all of the decisions for the asset distribution, and now the business closes and we're told it's going to be closed for 3 or 4 months, and it's a business that may not be able to tolerate that much closure? How do you handle things when you're still moving forward during COVID and that business isn't making money?
Well, as a, and you know, this is a discussion I'd like to have with JB, is that, as you correctly pointed out, the valuation of a business on the balance sheet has to be done at a specific time. Generally, it's measured at the date of trial, but you can get a different valuation date if you make a motion. So, for example, if you'd had a, let's say there had been a business and you made a motion and the court decided you were going to use a date of separation or a different valuation date prior to trial, and then, of course, COVID kicks in and the business is a restaurant and it's going to, you know, it's virtually going bankrupt now, okay? I guess I'd go back into court and ask for a different, you know, extraordinary circumstance and ask for a different valuation date. And it does present incredible problems. I'm not sure how attorneys are dealing with that. I think the, you know, the most, if there's a way to reserve jurisdiction or have a, you know, wait and see approach, that makes more sense. Now, that wait and see approach might be forced upon litigants by the very virtue of trials being continued, because for the most part, many trials are being continued now. And so you might, you know, a case that was perhaps going to trial in the summer might now be continued out until next year. So at that time, you'll have a clearer sense of what's going on in the economy. But what's going on right now is almost like a wartime situation. You don't really know what's going to happen. It's much worse than what happened in 2008, 2009 with the real property market. And so when you don't know what value is going to be in the future, I mean, look, what's going on with the S&P and the Dow right now to me is insane. Makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I just don't understand it at all. But, you know, all the metrics tell us that we're going to go into a huge recession, if not a depression. And so business valuation, just like cash flow, it's got to be reality-based. Business valuation, as JB mentioned, is usually a function of earnings, capitalization of either earnings or excess earnings. But it built into that model is the notion that those earnings are going to continue. And the risk factors that they will not continue or there'll be a change based upon the industry, based upon maybe the age of the people working in the business, that kind of thing, you can build some of that risk and into your multiples and how you capitalize those earnings. But the end of the, you know, but what JB was talking about was sort of risk that in the past has been fairly knowable. But this COVID thing, I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen and how it's going to impact the economy in the long term. And it's very much, it seems to be very much an industry-based or sector-based problem. So I mentioned restaurants have been very badly impacted. And there's probably other personal services businesses which are going to be impacted even worse. On the other hand, if you're valuing a business, maybe like Amazon or a cloud-based business, for example, where everybody can work from home and actually revenue has been increasing over this period, you're going to take an entirely different approach to that. So I think you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. How's that, JB?
Yeah, that's really great. That is great. I would just clarify for the listeners too, what we're talking about with COVID and these other things is risk, right? And I want them to understand that the greater the risk, the lower the business value. Okay, so more risky business means lower value. A less risky business means a higher business value. So that, you know, that's the background of when we're talking about COVID and the risk of these government shutdowns lasting longer and all of that uncertainty. Uncertainty equals risk equals lower value.
Excellent, literally excellent information. I would like to conclude, because we have very little time left, but I would like to conclude with a little bit about support, child and spousal support. So both spouses have been hit hard. They're either on unemployment or they're at a reduced salary right now, and support is under discussion. How are you handling it?
Do you want to answer first, JB?
Yeah, another question that nobody knows the answers to, and I think it's to take all the considerations in factor in all the considerations. My first instinct is to think, okay, how is a party living? Okay, because living expenses are being paid from some source, either being paid from savings or from loans or from just reducing other business expenses, but you know the ongoing life of the payor spouse. I would look for evidence that that lifestyle changed. If that lifestyle did not change, then it leads to why would support be changing? If it did change, the lifestyle change, then you know support should likewise probably change. And maybe you look at percentage drops. Maybe you look at trying to work out a deal with the other side to defer support payments till a time when it comes back. You know, the problem with these types of support payments, and I classify this COVID world as very similar to those folks who are approaching retirement age too. It's support's not based on your prediction of income. It's based on like the court's prediction of your income. And I would argue that, you know, it shouldn't really be a prediction anyway. It needs to be based in something. So in our work, you know, we're determining the actual income that somebody made. But in every case of mine, it's always backwards looking. It's always looking into the past to project the future. Well, what you're describing and what all of us are feeling in this COVID is very happening in the current time. It could rebound in a month or two, or it might not for a year or two. But those things are unknown. And so if you're a couple out there, you know, in a supporting role, either supporting or being supported, you know, try to be flexible, try to work it out with the other person, and try to really reflect what's actually happening, not so much people's fears and anxiety about what they're going to make. Get through right now. Do the next best thing rather than worrying about longer term things. Now, if over a period of time, you know, like Warren mentioned earlier, the courts are overwhelmed, the courts are crowded, the courts have been closed and pushing things out. So by the time that this actually gets before a judge, you might know the answers because you might have either rebounded or be in a you know, in a known place rather than an unknown place financially. Does that make
sense? Well, yeah, one of the things I would, how much more time do we have, by the way?
I would say about 5 minutes.
Okay. Can I run down the clock then?
Sure. Don't forget, you have to tell people how to get in touch with you still.
Sure. Run out the clock.
Okay. First of all, I'm Warren Scheel. Go to my website, la-familylaw.com. I've been a divorce attorney, an attorney in the UK, New York, and California for about 30 years. I'm a certified specialist. Our office number is 310-247-9913. JB, you just want to...
Hold on. You're an opportunist.
Absolutely.
Question. Answer the support question first.
Okay. Okay. So I think everything, the practical aspects of this was covered by JB, which is that you've got to be reality-based. I mean, we hear that so often now, don't we? When we talk about COVID and we talk about, like, how's it going to affect us? Should we make decisions based on realities of what public health officials tell us and what science tells us? Or should we make it based upon what politicians tell us who want to get elected? So, and I think everybody's in agreement, at least everyone in California is in agreement, that we should it should be reality-based. And that's the same with, I think, support. The fact is that everyone's been affected. Now, there are a couple of things you can do to sort of maybe create a framework of reality and reasonableness about this. And I would say the starting point is that the model is broken down. We used to, in the family code, statute presumes the last 12 months is presumptively the correct income. But it's always been the case that that's based upon the assumption that the next 12 months will be more or less the same. Now, if you have fluctuating income because of bonuses or just because you're in a type of job where your income fluctuates, we often do what's called a Smith-Osler or Osler-Smith, which means we decide what the basic amount of income you're receiving now is, okay? It could be unemployment, could be just very reduced income. And then we say that over the next 12 months, we will, if your income increases or you receive a bonus or a commission, you pay a percentage of that to the receiving a parent or spouse. So that's one way of doing it, is have that Smith-Osler in place and then reserve jurisdiction. And what I like to do is oftenly have a true-up. In other words, when both parties prepare their tax returns at the end of the year, maybe in March or April, they meet with their accountants to see what actually happened. And if it turns out they paid too much or too little, then there's a credit or debit that they'll pay the other person. So that's a framework, I think, a very helpful framework to look at this. But you have to be reality-based. You can't be doing what I've seen a lot of attorneys say, oh, but you were making so much money, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And of course, now their business is closed, they're not making any income. The only income they're getting is maybe through investments. So you've got to look at what the income is now, to at least provide a base.
So in that case, you can either do what you can do right now, understanding this is atypical of how you normally have earned, and or the word reserved when you're writing the settlement agreements, that's an option, right, Warren? You can, if everybody can kind of get along right now, just scraping by, let's not make any decisions. Let's reserve until we're at a point where there's a little money to go around. Is that an option?
I think so. And then in terms of like enforcement mechanisms or, you know, I would definitely, if you have a lot of money, you know, go to mediation. You know, or hire a private judge, or maybe hire JB as a joint forensic to do a calculation. And so you're looking for alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, not the court system.
I was so proud of the attorneys that I saw talking on the family law listserv of one of the bar associations I belong to. And this was at the beginning of COVID. It was late March. And people who had already received their judgments for divorce, the topic was coming up, wait a minute, I'm not receiving an income. What are we going to do about these payments? And the attorneys were saying that they were getting these calls. People wanted to go to court. And the attorneys, by and large, were saying, this is an unusual situation. Let's work it out. Let's at least mediate. Let's not go to court. Well, first of all, the court wasn't available. But I was really proud that the lawyers stepped in and said, hold on a minute. Let's get a little bit more reality-based, a little more sensitive, and let's be open to what each other is going through right now. And I thought that was a credit to the community. And with that, I'm not going to let you put your foot in your mouth, Warren. So you're going to once again tell people how to get in touch with you. Accept that compliment, please.
Thank you. Tufa, la-familylaw.com. My telephone number is 310-247-9913. And I'm a reality-based divorce attorney. And
yes, you are. Attorney. With a heart. With a total heart.
With a heart. And well, I hope that reality does have a heart, yeah.
JB, how about you?
Sure. Thanks, Judy. I'm JB Rizzo. I'm a CPA in California and Nevada. But all I do is these family law for litigation and mediation. My firm is Frankel Reichman and Rizzo. Our website is www.calcpaexpert.com. That's CALCPAEXPERT.com. Our phone number is 323-549-2160. Thank
Say
you.
That one more time for the audience.
Sure. 323-549-2160.
And on all of my social media, you will see both JB and Warren's names and easily can Google both of them. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining us. And for all of you, you have been listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host, amicable divorce expert. You can reach me at Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com. Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com. I look forward to our next episode. Take care.